With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, and you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I'm your host, Tracy Savage. Let's hear some tunes to start tonight off.
We'll be right back.
there, and let's talk about molecules, matter, and energy this week in science news. 3D effects without the glasses? Well, listen to this. A new type of hologram provides a 3D image without the glasses. Oh yeah. And unlike traditional holograms, this one comes in color. Current 3D television technologies rely on overlapping images to give the illusion of depth. But the new technique developed by the Japanese scientists and published in the April 8th edition of Science uses white light to energize electrons in a thin film of metal. This energy reveals a hologram pre-etched by lasers into a second overlying layer. Colorful apples, roses, and origami cranes created this way maintain their appearance when seen from different angles, unlike the kinds of holograms used on credit cards. And X-rays rubbed out? Well, a simple way to make X-rays could lead to portable devices for medics in the field. Seth Puterman of UCLA built a machine that bumps rubber against hardened epoxy up to 20 times a second. Every touch discharges X-ray energy, much in the way that touching a doorknob can release a lower energy static shock. The mechanism behind this triboelectric effect, which also produces X-rays when scotch tape is peeled from a surface, is still largely unknown. By testing different materials, Puterman hopes to boost the strength of the X-rays tenfold to create machines that could run on a 12-volt battery. Now, quantum bits. The quantum bit record, the new world record for linking together quantum bits or qubits, brings quantum computing one step closer to usefulness. An international team of researchers entangled 14 atoms so they behave like a single quantum particle. This feat trumps the previous record of 10 quantum bits, published in March 31st issue of Physical Review Letters. The experiment uncovers a difficulty that quantum computing will face as the number of bits continues to rise. As the number of qubits increases, boosting the computing power, the stability of the special quantum state that allows these atoms to store information falls more rapidly than expected. And there's a new study that's being argued about with scientists suggesting that the unexplained deceleration of both Pioneer 10 and 11 can be accounted for by the heat reflected off the craft's components, but some researchers just are not convinced. Now, this puzzling deceleration of the Pioneer 10 and 11 spacecrafts as they drift toward the edge of the solar system is almost certainly due to forces generated by onboard heating elements rather than an exotic force or modification of gravity, a new study has concluded. But other researchers are saying that this study, posted April 1st at arxiv.org, doesn't fully explain the anomalous motion. Researchers first reported in 1998 that the sun's pull couldn't fully account for the deceleration of the craft, which were launched in the early 1970s and are now drifting in opposite directions well beyond the orbit of Pluto. Some theorists invoke new physics to explain the tiny slowdown, and their formula would equate to about 10 billion times smaller than the tug of Earth's gravity. Other scientists suggested that infrared radiation or heat emitted and reflected by different parts of the craft might account for at least some of the deceleration. Now, because of the craft's orientation relative to Earth, the net recoil of infrared photons reflected from different parts of the craft would create a force that would slow the craft down. Now, using a new computer model, Orfeo Bertolomi of the Instituto Superior Technique in Lisbon and the University of Porto in Portugal and his colleagues say that they have done a more careful job than previous attempts of calculating the amount of heat emitted and reflected by the craft's components, which are powered by tiny nuclear generators. The team adapted a technique called Phong shading, developed in the 1970s, to model how objects reflect visible light to determine how parts of the two craft would reflect heat. The researchers find that the net forces generated by the emission and reflection of heat are enough to account for the deceleration. Now, this is a quote. With the results presented here, the puzzle of the anomalous acceleration of the Pioneer probes can finally be put to rest, unquote, the team had concluded. But John Anderson, a retired NASA scientist who published the first study of the craft's unaccounted for deceleration 13 years ago, explains that an analysis of heat emitted by the two probes doesn't account for all of the anomalous motion. Anderson then suggests that because of uncertainties in modeling, the heat emitted and reflected from the probes and the acceleration question may not be settled until another spacecraft is carefully monitored as it travels to the edge of the solar system. Theorists have variously suggested that Einstein's theory of gravitation needs modification. Oh, controversy, here we go again, and this would mean that the deceleration of the craft is an illusion due to variations in the speed of light. Victor Toth, a software developer based in Ottawa, who has studied the Pioneer puzzle for several years, agrees that forces generated by thermal effects will end up accounting for much of the deceleration, but he believes the problem can be solved only by taking the material properties of the spacecraft surfaces and structures into account and building a detailed computer model that accounts for the heat generated by all the craft's components, undertaking all that would require time and money. Quote, however frustrating the wait is, and believe me, it is frustrating, jumping the gun would not serve anybody, Toth says. And we will await that computer model and see if there's a difference in what has been reported versus who's arguing with it. And we'll bring that to you right here on Savage Science Radio. And this week marks the 50th anniversary of the first manned space flight by Yuri Gagarin from the Soviet Union. Here's a little bit about his life, and his 75th birthday would have been on March 9th.
I had the honor of taking the Vostok, a great spacecraft, to space first. I was very happy to have that honor. It was only the beginning.
April 12, 1961, the day Yuri Gagarin blasted off into space, orbited the Earth, and made history. A feat celebrated across the globe.
It was incredible. It was hard to believe that this actually happened.
But for this man, it was also the day his name shot to fame.
My parents didn't know where I was serving. They only knew I had graduated from a pilot's academy and that the facility I was working at was top secret. When they heard that Yuri Gagarin had been sent into space, they assumed it was me. Journalists came to our house to interview my parents, but they knew nothing. I think they could have had a heart attack.
He had met the Yuri Gagarin in 1963 while working at the launch pad. He ended up face-to-face with a man and introduced himself.
He asked me what month I was born. I said March, and it seemed to me like he was going to collapse. I even stretched out my hands to hold him up. It turned out he was born in March as well.
Monuments like this one will serve as a reminder for future generations of man's first journey into space. But for now, there are still those who can tell the story of Yuri Gagarin and that momentous day from memory, adding another layer of color to history.
Ada Kotovskaya was a doctor who prepared Gagarin for his first flight. She recalls that very day 50 years ago.
Gagarin looked more pale than usual. He was unsociable and quiet, which was not like him at all. He would answer by nodding or a short yes to all questions. Sometimes he would start humming some tunes. This was a different Gagarin. We geared him up and hugged, and I said, "Yuri, everything will be fine." And he nodded back.
As soon as Gagarin returned to Earth, he was a superstar, a hero for his compatriots. Those who knew him admit they weren't quite sure how to act around him.
We were playing volleyball when Gagarin and another guy approached us. We all moved away embarrassed. He was very surprised. He said, "What's up? Let's play together." Those who played against him were giving way. Gagarin noticed this and was offended. He said, "Let's play fair, okay?"
You'd be hard-pressed to find someone who knew Gagarin and has a bad word to say. After all, he was chosen not just for his abilities as a cosmonaut, but also for his demeanor and signature smile. Certainly not a bad reputation to be associated with for this Yuri Gagarin. Tessa Arcilia, RT.
And in an alternate history universe, one would have to ask, would a Soviet moon landing have forced the U.S. to go to Mars? Well, Yuri Gagarin's historic flight was just one of many Soviet victories in the space race, but the United States still won the big victory when it landed on the moon. But what if the Russians had gotten there first. Now that is the question that's being explored by Piers Bizany, co-writer of the Gagarin biography Starman, as well as a space historian, Dr. Christopher Riley. In an interview with BBC News, Bizany and Riley imagine how things might be different if the Soviet Union had made it to the moon before the United States, itself an unlikely but not entirely impossible eventuality. The key factor here might be the differing motivations of the Soviet and American space programs, as Bizany explains. Quote, "The Russians were in the business of conquering space. The Americans felt they were in a race, and the nature of a race is that once you think you've won it, you tend to stop running," quote unquote. So whereas for the U.S. reaching the moon was an end in of itself, as evidenced by the fact that after six successful moon landings between 1969 and 1972, we've never even so much as left low Earth orbit since, the Soviet Union might well have had grander plans in mind. As a totalitarian regime, the USSR would not have had to contend with growing apathy towards lunar flights in the same way that NASA did, allowing them to pour far more resources into continued exploration of the moon if they so chose. Now, under those circumstances, the U.S. would have had little choice but to go to the moon as well, and that means the space race would have kept right on going. Dr. Riley thinks moon bases might have been a legitimate possibility if both the U.S. and the Soviet Union remained committed to the space race after the first lunar landing, but even that might have paled in comparison to the full American response to a Soviet moon landing. Dr. Riley explains that a mission to Mars would have been the only logical response. Quote, "They certainly had it in their minds and on their drawing boards, and there were designs of methods to get to Mars that might have been put into action in response to a Soviet landing on the moon. The history that followed in the decades afterwards would have been completely different," unquote. Mars was seen as a legitimate goal for the U.S. space program in the late 1960s, at least by politicians. In 1969, Vice President Spiro Agnew predicted NASA would have Americans on Mars by 1980, which didn't seem entirely ridiculous considering the incredible strides made over the previous decade. Of course, whatever Americans' technological capabilities, and it's hard to judge whether the Apollo program and other contemporary engineering efforts could have really gotten us to Mars. But there were, you know, they were nothing against the growing tide of the public disinterest, which is basically the biggest problem here, apathy. And for more on why the U.S. ultimately overtook the Soviets and declared victory in the space race, you can check out BBC News. They've got all kinds of cool stories because of this anniversary this week. And here's a little music break. To reality, reviving human spaceflight. Well, to revive NASA's human spaceflight program with the ultimate goal of sending humans to Mars for reals, and we've talked about this several times on this show, and the entrepreneurial projects that are going on, the space agency should increase the scale and scope of studies in the life sciences and the physical sciences over the next decade, a new National Research Council report recommends. The report, released April 5th, also examines the role of the International Space Station in this research. Let's hope the budget cuts don't get any worse. And in another piece of news here, a dark source of life. Now, in some cases, dark matter rather than starlight may provide energy for life to emerge, evolve, and survive on planets. Particles of dark matter that collide and annihilate could generate the requisite energy. Dan Herper of the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory in Batavia, Illinois, and Jason Steffen of the University of Chicago have proposed. A large planet residing in a region with a high density of slow-moving dark matter could plausibly capture and annihilate enough dark matter to maintain temperatures at which liquid water could exist on the orb's surface, even in the absence of starlight. The researchers reported this in a paper posted March 29th at arxiv.org. Busy little site we got going on there this week. And can massive inhabited planets exist in weird space-time orbit inside black holes? Quote, advanced civilizations may live safely inside the supermassive black holes in the galactic nuclei without being visible from the outside, unquote. Vyacheslav Dokuchev at the Institute for Nuclear Research of the Russian Academy of Sciences in Moscow just said this. Now, we love Russian astrophysicists at the Daily Galaxy because of things like this. The discovery of stable orbits inside certain kinds of black hole implies that planets and perhaps even life could survive inside these weird objects, says Dukachev at the Russian Academy of Sciences. Now, Dukachev points out that certain black holes can have a complex internal structure that could allow photons, particles, and perhaps even planets to orbit the central singularity without ever getting sucked all the way in. Cosmologists have been aware for some time that there are regions inside charged rotating black holes where objects such as photons can survive in stable periodic orbits. Dokuchev's contribution is to study these orbits in detail and to explore their dynamics. Now, one of the problems that would at first seem to negate any chance of planetary orbits inside a black hole is that inside the event horizon of a black hole, radio dimension becomes time-like rather than space-like. Conventional orbits are clearly impossible, but further in, there is another horizon where the dimensions switch back again, at least inside charged and rotating black holes. Now, this is the inner Cauchy horizon, and it's beyond here that Dukachev says the interesting orbits for massive planets exist. Dukachev calculates that the stable orbits are non-equatorial and have a rich structure. They would also be brightly illuminated by the central singularity and by photons trapped in the same orbit. Dukachev also believes that a planet in such an orbit could support a complex chemistry that is rich enough to allow life to evolve, hence his quote, again, advanced civilizations may live safely inside the supermassive black holes in the galactic nuclei without being visible from the outside. Now, such a civilization would be subject to a huge tidal forces and energy density that builds up in these stable orbits as photons become trapped. There's also the problem of causality violations, which some cosmologists predict would afflict this kind of weird space-time. Now, you can see pictures of this active galaxy NGC 1097 obtained with the NACO Adaptive Optics Instrument in ESO's Very Large Telescope over at the Daily Galaxy, if you so desire. And speaking of weird space and time warps, physicists have discovered a new way to visualize warped space and time. When black holes slam into each other, the surrounding space and time surge and undulate like a heavy sea during a storm. This warping of space and time is so complicated that physicists haven't been able to understand the details of what goes on until now. We have found ways to visualize warped space-time like never before, says Kip Thorne, Feynman Professor of Theoretical Physics, Emeritus at California Institute of Technology, Caltech. By combining theory with computer simulations, Thorne and his colleagues at Caltech, Cornell University, and the National Institute for Theoretical Physics in South Africa have developed conceptual tools that they've dubbed Tendex lines and vortex lines. Very interesting. Let's hear more about this, right? Using these tools, they have discovered that black hole collisions can produce vortex lines that form a donut-shaped pattern flying away from the merged black hole like smoke rings. The researchers also found that these bundles of vortex lines called vortexes or vortices can spiral out of the black hole like water from a rotating sprinkler. The researchers explained that tendex and vortex lines and their implications for black holes in a paper that's published online on April 11th in the journal Physical Review Letters. Tendex and vortex lines describe the gravitational forces caused by warped space-time. They are analogous to electric and magnetic field lines that describe electric and magnetic forces. Tandex lines describe the stretching force that warped space-time exerts on everything it encounters. Tandex lines sticking out of the moon raise the tides on the Earth's oceans, says David Nichols, the Caltech graduate student who coined the term Tandex. Now, the stretching force of these lines would rip apart an astronaut who falls into the black hole. Very bad. Vortex lines, on the other hand, describe the twisting of space. If an astronaut's body is aligned with a vortex line, she gets wrung like a wet towel. Now, when many tandex lines are bunched together, they create a vortex of strong stretching called a tandex. Similarly, a bundle of vortex lines creates a whirling region of space called a vortex. Anything that falls into a vortex gets spun around and around, says Dr. Robert Orwin of Cornell University, the lead author of the paper. Now, tandex and vortex lines provide a powerful way to understand black holes, gravity, and the nature of the universe. Using these tools, we can now make a much better sense of this tremendous amount of data that's produced in our computer simulations, says Dr. Mark Scheel, a senior researcher at Caltech and the leader of the team's simulation work. Using computer simulations, the researchers have discovered that two spinning black holes crashing into each other produce several vortexes and several tandexes. Now, if the collision is head-on, the merged hole ejects vortexes as donut-shaped regions of whirling space and ejects tandexes as donut-shaped regions of stretching. But if the black holes spiral in towards each other before merging, their vortexes and tandexes spiral out of the merged hole. In either case, donut or spiral, the outward moving vortexes and tandexes become gravitational waves, the kinds of waves that the Caltech-led laser interferometer gravitational wave observatory, or LIGO, seeks to detect. With these tandexes and vortexes, we may be able to more easily predict the waveforms of gravitational waves that LIGO is searching for, says Yanbai Chen, associate professor of physics at Caltech and the leader of the team's theoretical efforts. Additionally, tandexes and vortexes have allowed the researchers to solve the mystery behind the gravitational kick of a merged black hole at the center of a galaxy. Now, in 2007, a team at the University of Texas in Brownsville, led by Professor Manuela Campanelli, used computer simulations to discover that colliding black holes can produce a directed burst of gravitational waves that causes the merged black hole to recoil like a rifle firing a bullet. Now, the recoil is so strong that it can throw the merged hole out of its galaxy, but nobody understood how this directed burst of gravitational waves is produced. Equipped with their new tools now, Thorne's team has found the answer. On one side of the black hole, the gravitational waves from the spiraling vortexes add together with the waves from the spiraling tandexes. On the other side, the vortex and tandex waves cancel each other out. The result is a burst of waves in one direction, causing the merged hole to recoil. Though we've developed these tools for black hole collisions, they can be applied wherever space-time is warped, says Dr. Jeffrey Lovelace, a member of the team from Cornell. Quote, for instance, I expect that people will apply vortex and tandex lines to cosmology, to black holes ripping stars apart, and to the singularities that live inside black holes. They'll become standard tools throughout general relativity. Now, the team is already preparing for multiple follow-up papers, of course, with new results. I've never before co-authored a paper where essentially everything is new, says Thorne, who has co-authored hundreds of articles, but that's the case here. The research was supported by the National Science Foundation, the Sherman Fairchild Foundation, the Brinson Foundation, NASA, and the David and Barbara Gross Fund. So you can look that up there, and we're going to be expecting more papers to be coming out of this, and groundbreaking fantastic new news in the world of theoretical physics. And there's a baffling blow-up in a distant galaxy. The images are found right on NASA. There was a high-energy blast, and it's gone on for 11 days. Astronomers have witnessed this cosmic explosion so strange they don't even know what to call it. Although the blow-up discovered with NASA's Swift satellite on March 28th emits high-energy radiation like a gamma-ray burst would, the event has now lasted for 11 days. Gamma ray bursts last for an average of about 30 seconds. So I guess they know it's not that. Also, unlike a gamma ray burst, the explosion has faded and brightened, emitting staccato pulses of energetic radiation lasting for hundreds of seconds. Now, quote, it's either a phenomenon we've never seen before or a familiar event that we've never viewed in this way before, unquote, says Sandro Fruchter of the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. The outburst might have been generated by a star torn to shreds when it ventured too close to a black hole in its host galaxy, he suggests. Gas from the star falling into the black hole could have triggered the gravitational monster to emit a jet of X-rays and gamma rays that by chance happens to point directly at Earth. Ah! A radio wavelength image taken March 29th along with a Hubble Space Telescope image taken in visible light on April 4th supports that model. The images show that the explosion took place 3.8 billion light years from Earth at the center of the galaxy where a supermassive black hole would lie. It's also possible that the star might have been ripped apart by a smaller black hole, Fruchter notes. Tidal disruption of a star by a black hole seems very plausible, says Andrew McFadden of New York University. The blast duration, quote, is much longer than anything we'd naturally expect from an explosive collapse of a single star, unquote, which is the traditional model for producing a gamma ray burst, he says. But Stan Woolsey of the University of California, Santa Cruz, says that the event might be explained by the gravitational collapse of a giant star into a black hole, scaled up version of the process that usually produces a gamma ray burst that they know of already. In Woolsey's scenario, the core of the giant star collapses to form a black hole, but it takes days for the outer layers to fall in and emit radiation, accounting for the unusually long duration of the observed explosion. If you want to see pictures of that, you can go right on NASA. They've got them everywhere. Very, very interesting. Now, in the spirit of innovation that has driven the human species to become what we are today, technological mess, very interesting stuff, and understanding the world around us, making communication easier and everything else, there was a very interesting car that was developed in the 1940s, and it hit the wall with some of the bigger corporations, the big three, that were around at the time. This was the 1948 Tucker sedan, or the Tucker 48 sedan, initially named the Tucker Torpedo. Now, this was an advanced automobile conceived by Preston Tucker and briefly produced in Chicago in 1948. Only 51 cars were made before the company folded on March 3, 1949, due to negative publicity initiated by the news media, a Securities and Exchange Commission investigation, and a heavily publicized stock fraud trial, which allegations were proven baseless in court with a full acquittal. I might add, speculation exists that the circumstances which brought the Tucker Corporation down were contributed by the big three automakers and the Michigan Senator Homer S. Ferguson. The 1988 movie Tucker, The Man and His Dream is based on Tucker's spirit and the saga surrounding the car's production. Now, in this time of economic stress and everybody trying to conserve, they can't afford the gas, the oil concerns, all of these things are forcing us to have to be innovative and look to new ideas. Well, here's something from our American past that shows sometimes how hard it is for our smaller businesses to become as popular as a big business, and they're big business for a reason, which I'm not going to launch into a diatribe about on this show. Maybe a future show, I will. But right now, we're talking about technology. And new it was, this Tucker car, a torpedo-shaped fastback four-door sedan. The Tucker 48 looked just like the car of the future, expected to by long, war-weary Americans, styled by the forward-thinking Alex Tremulous. On a 128-inch wheelbase, it was 219 inches long, but only 60 inches high, low for the day. Engineering broke just as sharply from Detroit Convention, with an all-independent suspension and rear-mounted flat six. The latter derived from a wartime air-cooled helicopter unit, but boasted a fully sealed water cooling system, an industry first. Horsepower was 166, and a torque was a thumping 372 pound-feet from 335 cubic inches, yet an all-alloy power plant just weighed 320 pounds, and the chassis was a sturdy box section perimeter type with a subframe at each end. Lack of time, money, and even technology precluded a curved windshield, disc brakes, a torsolistic rubber springs, and other innovations proposed by Preston. But the car still had novelties aplenty. Central Cyclops eye headlight that turned with front wheels. Doors cut into the roof to ease entry-exit, a roomy six-passenger cabin with a step-down floor, an interchangeable front-rear seats to even out upholstery wear. Safety features abounded, too, and included massive bumpers, a recessed or protected knobs, buttons, and levers, windshield glass that popped out harmlessly on impact, and a quote-unquote safety chamber where front passengers could dive in case of impending collision. Despite its size and 4,200 pounds of heft, the Tucker could manage the 0 to 60 miles per hour sprint in about 10 seconds. Yep. Probably why they called it the torpedo. Top speed was at least 120 miles per hour, thanks to the aerodynamic styling, with an estimated drag factor of 0.30, good even today. Factory tests showed that a credible 20 miles per gallon at a steady 50 to 55 miles per hour was maintained. Just as nice, the rear engine layout, alt-dependent suspension, and center-point steering combined for surprisingly easy handling and secure road holding. Now, they also called this the Tin Goose, by the way. Not the Spruce Goose. This is the one on land. The Tucker would have probably a solid well, despite a Cadillac like projected price of some $4,000 back in the day, but production ended on only 50 cars, sadly, and
all were built before August 1948, and the last 37 on short assembly line in a refurbished wartime Dodge plant on Chicago's South Side. Now, believe it or not, and there was a movie about Preston Tucker called Tucker, the Man and His Dream. It was made in 1998, and it starred Jeff Bridges, Joan Allen, Martin Lando, and it was directed by Francis Ford Coppola. And here is a little bit of the compelling speech that he makes from this true life story in front of the jury when he was taken to that famous trial.
When I was a boy, I used to read all about Edison and the Wright brothers, Mr. Ford. They were my heroes. Rags to Riches, that's not just the name of a book. That's what this country was all about. We invented the free enterprise system where anybody, no matter who he was, where he came from, what class he belonged to, if he came up with a better idea about anything, no limit to how far he could go. I grew up a generation too late, I guess, because now the way the system works, the loner, the dreamer, the crackpot who comes up with some crazy idea that everybody laughs at, that later turns out to revolutionize the world, he's squashed from above before he even gets his head out of the water, because the bureaucrats, they'd rather kill a new idea than let it rock the boat. If Benjamin Franklin were alive today, he'd be thrown in jail for sailing a kite without a license. It's true. We're all puffed up with ourselves now because we invented the bomb. Beat the daylights out of the Japanese, the Nazis. But if big business closes the door on the little guy with a new idea, we're not only closing the door on progress, but we're sabotaging everything that we fought for. Everything that the country stands for.
And Tucker's dreams and words live on with the Tucker Automobile Club of America. You can find that on a really cool website, www.tuckerclub.org, and they still meet. They've got, you can see a Tucker for real right in front of your face, and they have a Tucker store, they have a historical collection library, and it's a very cool site, so check it out. And what he said then is no more true then than it is today, big time. I think he actually was a visionary, in my opinion. And in my entire lifetime, we have heard nothing but fighting over oil. So people are looking towards alternative fuel. What about electricity? Well, in Texas, they just started the first electric charging stations. The EVgo chain of charging stations for electric vehicles had its official coming out party last week in Dallas, Texas. And according to CNET News, the first U.S. commercial chain of charging stations, EVgo, will reportedly have a total of 60 electric vehicle charging stations in place by Labor Day this year, 2011. Believe it or not, this isn't pretend. EVgo is owned by NRG EV Services, a subsidiary of NRG Energy, and is one of the largest electricity providers in Texas. NRG EV Services and EVgo have not yet announced their specific pricing structure and plans for station customers, but EVgo did say its plans for offering a subscription service through which customers can get unlimited access to its stations for a set monthly fee, according to CNET reports. EVgo also announced it is developing a smartphone app that will alert users to nearby charging stations. The EVgo network announced this in November that it had partnered with some leading Texas retailers, and I think we talked about that right on this show, to provide space in their parking lots for charging stations, including Walgreens, believe it or not. The Walgreens pharmacy chain will host 18 of the rapid charging stations at its Houston area stores. Other partners include electronics retailer Best Buy, stores in the HEB market, or HEB market chain, and the airport parking company Park & Fly. The EVgo network would consist of two types of charging stations, 480-volt DC rapid chargers, which will take about 30 minutes to recharge an electric vehicle, and 240-volt level 2 chargers, which will take about 4 hours to recharge a vehicle. The EVgo quote-unquote freedom stations will be open 24 hours a day and offer both types of chargers. 25 of those will be open in the Dallas and Fort Worth area, and 35 in the Houston area by Labor Day, they said. So a total of 70 will be in place in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and 50 in the Houston area by 2012, according to NRG. Eventually, EVgo plans to roll out convenience stations that will be limited to 240-volt chargers and only open for service during business hours of the retailer hosting the station. So anybody who thinks there's not innovation going on with fuel, that's one idea that's out there. And part of the problem why people don't have electric cars is because they don't have the availability. They can only do it at home. So having these stations provides a much more tandem situation, like when you're going to work or on a trip. So it looks like right now a good place to go if you have an electric car for a trip is Texas. Specifically in the Dallas-Fort Worth or Houston areas in the next year. And speaking of other electric vehicles poised to enter the mainstream, Tesla is one. Tesla Roadsters, Nissan Leafs, and Chevy Volts are already on the market, and every major automaker has at least one electric model in the pipeline, giving consumers an array of choices in the coming years. The new wave of EVs just beginning to hit American highways is not the first. They were popular a century ago until cheaper gasoline-powered cars gained dominance after World War I. Believe it or not, people probably don't know this, but experts say the stars now appear to be aligned for an alternative to the internal combustion engine. This time it feels real, says Roland Huang, a director of the National Resources Defense Council's transportation programs. Automakers are serious. There's oil price shocks, yes, and the long-term trends are very positive. There will be potholes in the road as this rolls out, but there aren't any showstoppers. Advocates argue that EVs are not simply another type of car, but a game changer for the country. They say that widespread adoption of electric vehicles will help cut the greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to global warming and enhance national security by reducing the country's dependence on foreign oil. The transition to EVs won't happen overnight, however. Current models have a limited range and are more expensive than most comparable gas-powered cars, making them unappealing to many drivers. But EV prices are expected to decline as high volume production pushes manufacturing costs down. In Silicon Valley, startups are racing to improve battery technology as well, which should allow the cars to go farther between charges. That's cool. And when that happens, manufacturers and enthusiasts hope electric cars will become a viable option for millions of Americans. Now, tech-savvy early adopters such as Felix Kramer and the Rochelle Lefkowitz, I always say that wrong, I said it right today, of Redwood City, California, are already sold. The couple outfitted their Toyota Prius, which operates, and this was actually a video that you can find on YouTube, on electricity as well as gas, and a larger battery pack in 2006. In December, they bought one of the nation's first Chevy Volts, which run on electricity for about 40 miles before its gas engine kicks in. So that's kind of like the hybrid version there. In January, they added an all-electric Nissan Leaf to their household fleet, making them the only family in the nation known to own three plug-in vehicles. And they have been all over the place. You can look up some cool video on them. And keep your eyes open. We're going to be bringing you an awful lot more pros and cons on these electric vehicles in the coming weeks. I'm going to make sure I do a little spot every week on this particular technology that's emerging and some of the innovations that we are coming up with. We're being forced to. We can't live on oil forever, and there is not going to be any drill baby drill support on this particular show. Thank you very much. Well, that's about it for Savage Science Radio this week, and I'd like to thank Nick Peluco for the fantastic show graphics and the new one, which makes me look like I'm coming out of a Ray Bradbury novel. Very cool. Dennis Bond and Hawk Productions for the great intro that I use every single week. Waleed Al-Haddad, who helps me research and find these fantastic stories to bring to you and enlighten your life. And Todd Sheets, my executive producer, who's like magic with the technical aspect and auditory delights that you get to hear when you listen to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM. So, until next we meet again, keep your powder and your pants dry, and happy trails.
I am so high, I can hear heaven.
I'm not